we are a group of 15 people, and mostly it's been between 12 and 14 who've actually been able to make it on any given night. And you come as far south as Mexico City, as far north as Nelson, British Columbia, as far west and northwest as California, Oregon, Washington State, and as far east as New York State, Vermont. So we've got a wonderful geographic range here. Even though we're a small group, we're really covering all of North America, which is very exciting. So thank you all for, you know, making it possible that you could all be here. So let me start out by, I'll probably spend about 20 minutes or so answering questions. You're not muted. And again, I think you can, you know, raise your hand if, with that five star, that may work if you have some more questions. And then I'm going to go into the nitty-gritty of the curriculum and block rotation in eighth grade. And I just want to say, if I forget to say it when I start to talk about it, you know, certainly there's a block rotation. Certainly there are classes that are traditionally taught. But it's really important for you also to feel great freedom in determining what's most important for your class. You know, if your class is just way behind in math, you may need to drop perhaps meteorology or world geography and focus more on math. Or if your class is really in great need of going more deeply into the history, maybe you do a more modest class play and spend more time on history. I hope that your school gives you that kind of leeway, because the eighth grade curriculum is relatively more of a patchwork than pretty much any other grade, and you have to see what's most important for the group that you have. So let's look at some of the questions. Margarita from Mexico City was asked about boyfriend, girlfriend questions. She said, we haven't had this problem yet, but I think that other teachers in her school might be worried if eighth grade couples were holding hands or embracing each other lovingly, because the rest of the younger children will start imitating them. What are the limits? And, you know, that she said there was a teacher's meeting last year, and because of the different and not so disciplined behavior of the seventh graders, they hadn't had a seventh grade in 30 years. So suddenly adolescent behavior, which nobody had seen for a long time, was a big surprise to everyone. Here again, you know, it depends a bit on what's already happened in your school. If you've had a whole number of eighth grades, generally mid-seventh to eighth grade, the children are going to start to see how far they can go and what they could get away with. Now, the most wonderful thing in this regard in the Waldorf classroom is that the children over the years have developed a kind of brotherly and sisterly connection with each other. And it's generally unusual. It's not out of the question, but it's more the exception than the rule than that a boy and a girl who've been together since kindergarten would ever start to act like boyfriend and girlfriend in eighth grade. That usually doesn't happen. It's usually begins with a girl who's come new, maybe who joined the class in grade 6 or 7, or even in grade 5. In her school, children were already starting to pair up by grade 4 or 5, you know, talking about boyfriends and girlfriends. So she feels she has to do that, that's expected of her. And she either will learn from the others that, no, we don't do that. You know, it's all very kind of incestuous here if you do that. Or she may start something. So it usually begins, and once again, there are exceptions to this, but it's usually something coming from outside. A child in a school where astrality is just flowing into the school at an earlier age and not being given any shape or form. But most of the boys and most of the girls are seeing each other much more as human beings and not so much in a sense of, you know, opposites attracting. On the other hand, what's going on between boys and girls in this age is on the whole much less sexual than is usually believed to be the case, and much more this general feeling that they have of wanting to find balance. The boys and the girls who are attracted to each other usually are very opposite in temperament. You're seeing actually one temperament trying to find balance in the opposite temperament. You'll often see a very tall girl and a very short boy, a very thin boy and a very round girl, a very lively girl and a very introverted boy. You will usually see children who are recognizing, I'm not complete, I'm not a whole person. And so they're drawn to the other. But of course, our culture, especially if they've seen some movies or been exposed to some media, our culture doesn't give them many parameters, many models of how to deal with the fact that you have a crush on somebody or you feel drawn to somebody on a soul level. Right away, it's thrown into the physical world. The rule that I had with my class, which was a first in my school where teachers were usually pretty lax about it, was, you know, you cannot be overly demonstrative that you're allowed to have a boyfriend or a girlfriend. You know, what you do after school is your parents' business and not mine in a way. But that when you're on the school grounds, be it recess, in our classroom, in the hall or whatever, you can't hold hands and you can't, you know, manifest outward affection to one another. And that's just it. I'm not going to allow that. And the kids actually, after trying it out and trying to see if I was really serious and how far I would go, they tried. I always was humorous about it, and I was always very understanding about it, and we had very nice conversations. I never read the Riot Act. I never, you know, got overly upset or whatever. And basically, it really went along like that. And in a class of 32 eighth graders, I'm speaking about maybe two couples. The other thing that goes on in eighth grade is because the girls in eighth grade feel that the boys in their class either are brotherly or are just a bunch of oafs, they very quickly lose interest in the boys in their class. So now they have a choice. If you have a high school, they may start to feel attracted to boys in the high school. This can create huge issues. So we won't go there for the moment. But what they more often do is eighth grade girls develop crushes on boys in grade six. This was so common in Green Meadow. And these poor sixth grade boys did not know what hit them, as three or four eighth grade girls were coming up to them, telling them that one of their friends in the eighth grade really liked him and maybe they could get together after school. Or what's his phone number? Or probably now they'd say, you know, what's your Facebook address or something like that. So this is more common in many schools than issues between the eighth graders themselves. It's that the girls just start to branch out either in directions above them or directions below them. Now, let me say something. If you've got a high school, and it may be that sometimes a shy ninth or 10th grade boy who's totally intimidated by the ninth or tenth grade girls, sets his sights a little bit lower and starts to get attracted to one or another eighth grade girl. This completely freaks out parents, and understandably so. I gave mothers advice about this, which I can tell you always worked, which was that if this boy calls the house, or if this boy shows up at the house, or in one way or another, this boy is making himself felt in the life of this girl, maybe even asking her to the high school prom, which sometimes happens to eighth grade girls, that what the mother should do is get very, very friendly with the boy. If he calls up and says he wants to talk to your daughter, before you let him talk to her, you start to talk to him. How are you, darling? It's so nice to hear your voice. How's the basketball team doing? I hear you're really good. Or, well, I hear, you know, you're a great science student. Tell me about that. And then you tell your daughter what a wonderful, wonderful fellow he is and how much you like him. And when he comes to the door to meet her, always spend some time, have him sit down on the couch with you and have a nice conversation with him. And I can assure you that your interest in that boy will cure your daughter of any interest that she might have in that boy. The only problem that arose once was then the boy told the girl he wasn't going to invite her to the prom after all, but instead he was taking her mother to the prom. That one didn't work out so well. But so that's one thing. I mean, that's not going to happen to most of you because you have the blessing of not having a high school with all those high school boys. But let me say something else about this boy-girl thing. Part of it, as I say, is temperamental. Part of it is on the personality level, that introverts get attracted to extroverts. Once again, it's about balance. But there's another factor here which is very important, and it's a very beautiful and very sensitive, but it could also be a very troublesome aspect of this. And that's the fact that there's never more than 50% of our astral body within us. The rest of our astral body is outside of us. So these young people, these eighth graders, are taking on the astral body more fully, more deeply than they ever have. It's something that's very, very strong within them right now. This means that the half of it that is not within them is also functioning very, very strongly. And that's one reason that they pick up on, you know, all the hormones, all the endocrine systems, all the testosterone and so on that's floating around in the classroom, that there's a certain helplessness that they have. You know, it isn't really them doing it consciously, but it's the astral body working very, very strongly. So you have to be sensitive to this, that things are going to happen, that you just have to be very awake, very aware. You also may now and then overhear some of the kids talking to each other in the classroom when they think you're not around. And the foul language that they will be using, the language they start to talk with, and the subjects that they're talking about. And once again, this is not really them. This is their astral body kind of using them as an instrument, you know, going out and flowing out around them. So this sort of thing is going to be with you. And it's just one of the things you need to talk to the parents about it and, you know, just show them that you are really aware of this. And another aspect of this is something that I didn't speak about on Monday when I was discussing parent work. Starting in fifth grade, I had my parents organize themselves into a support group where they would meet several times a year without me I wasn't there. They would meet and have discussions about their children's social life. Because in the upper grades, a lot of stuff is going to happen during the weekends, during vacations. It's going to happen when the kids decide to throw parties. And they may invite some people, they may not invite other people. It can be very selective. Feelings can be hurt. And some of this nowadays flows over into social media, which is another whole issue. If the parents are not aware of this, and if they're not talking with each other and creating a kind of safety net around the children, then you are going to be held responsible for everything that goes wrong, even though it happened on a Saturday night when you were miles away from the party or something like that. So you can't control everything. You've got to recognize the parents have to take on a great responsibility. If they're opposed to social networking, then they have to be the ones looking over their children's shoulders when they're on their computer or on their tablet or their iPhone. It's the parents who have to be aware of these things and the parents who have to be working with you. And if the parents get together several times a year and take up issues like curfews, parties, what kind of videos are appropriate for kids to watch together in eighth grade? What kinds of parties should they be having or whatever? Something that my parents decided to do in seventh grade, which I think was a lifesaver for my class, was that they decided that whenever the kids wanted to have a party, the parents would have a party as well. So that there would be a party going on in the basement of somebody's house, in the finished, you know, beautiful recreation room basement. That was the students' party. And meanwhile, the parents were having a party upstairs. And now and then a parent would go downstairs very informally, you know, not as a formal chaperone, but just going down to check in on things. And now and then some of the students would come upstairs to see how adults conduct their parties, which they found were actually rather boring. But this was a very powerful experience that the students were given a degree of freedom. You know, they were in another part of the house, but they knew that the parents were upstairs. And I think that really helped keep their astrality in a kind of form. You know, it gave it an invisible net. It created a kind of invisible neighborhood of supportive adults around the children. So that's another thing to consider, you know, with all of these issues. But you will also have to be working with your seventh grade teacher, your sixth grade teacher, even the kindergarten teachers, who may now and then get very, very upset when they see two eighth graders holding hands at a time when you're not around and you're not aware they're doing that, and will come back to you. People really panic about stuff like this, especially if eighth grade is new in your school. So you have to be prepared for colleagues who will panic, who will be very critical of you, you know, want you to be called on the carpet about this. Just expect that may happen. It's part, again, of the, you know, the loneliness of eighth grade. But I think you can also keep things at a certain level where it may not go too far and become something that's really inappropriate for a Waldorf school. Okay, so that's one thing. The other question that Margarita asked was about sexuality and sex education. So I've already spoken a little bit about this, that I think, you know, since the time of Freud, we've tended to exaggerate or overemphasize how much sexuality, how large a role that plays in seventh and eighth graders, certainly in the Waldorf school. I don't think it's as big a deal as it might be in other settings. On the other hand, the question is also, well, what about sex education? How do we work with that? Now, there are several approaches to that. when I was teaching in the 1970s and 1980s, it wasn't even an issue in at least in Waldorf schools on the East Coast. Nobody went near it. You know, Steiner only had one pretty dismissive comment to make in his lectures on adolescence, saying, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to be standing in front of a bunch of, you know, of teenage hoydens, as it's called in the English, the British translation of, you know, scoundrels of all these kids, and talk about that. That was all he said. So it certainly wasn't a big issue for him. Now, since then, there have been some sort of sex education curricula worked out, which go as far back as grade 4 or 5, because certainly girls are starting to mature at an earlier age, not necessarily emotionally maturing, but puberty is definitely coming earlier and earlier. And some of this is about getting the boys to be more sensitive about what the girls are going through, for them to help the boys understand this. So different people have, you know, you could just go online and write in Waldorf sex education, and you'll find some of these programs where people will come to your school, or you can go to a seminar, a training with all of this. And some teachers find that very, very helpful, and it really works well in their classes. Other schools, like my own, would bring in an anthroposophical doctor and an anthroposophical nurse. And the doctor would speak to the boys, and the nurse would speak to the girls, because it was assumed that the doctor was a man and the nurse would be a woman. Now, you can see already the kind of incredible sexism that's living in that. But anyway, that's how it was done. And they would get together with the students over a period of time, once a week, and they would bring to them, this was 7th or 8th grade, depending on what the teacher wanted, or both, these two professionals then would say to the kids, your class teacher isn't here, your parents aren't here, you can ask us any questions that you want, and we're happy to answer them, and we'll help you. And generally, the students liked this. They felt they were being spoken to in a new way, that, you know, they could really raise issues, that they told me, we wouldn't ever talk to you about this, because we'd feel embarrassed. And, you know, they feel in a certain way that the teacher is too pure, that he or she would be unable to manage to talk about these things. So it's a funny thing, but that sometimes happens. It's a very sort of delicate matter. So that's another way of working with it. Or in the 7th grade physiology class, and or the 8th grade anatomy class, the class teacher can start to bring these things. It's just in a certain way, I don't think anybody really quite has the key for quite the right way to do it. And it's one of these areas where all together, Steiner was still very much in the Victorian age, and he really gave us pretty much no help in how to work with these subjects. For all of his brilliant creativity and initiation wisdom, he left a gaping hole, which you know, wasn't a big issue in 1919, but is certainly every year a bigger and bigger issue for our schools. So that's how it is. In my old school, Green Meadow, in 10th grade, for years and years, in 10th grade, there was a course called Family and Relationships. And the students would call it the Too Late Sex Education class. They said, by the time we were in 10th grade, Mr. Schwartz, you know, it's not like we really had anything new to learn, or if it was new for us at that time, that was really a problem if you didn't already know it. So anyway, the school did make those efforts, but I think it's very difficult. Yeah, kids are so sophisticated nowadays. So I don't have a magic bullet for that, but you just might, you know, check in with other 8th grade teachers and see what they've done. Okay, so I'm going to speak. Margareta also had a question about block rotation, but I'm going to take that up in a little while when we speak more about blocks. Now, I had several questions about class plays and what recommendations do I have. Kelly spoke about her class having done a Much Ado About Nothing, a Shakespeare comedy in seventh grade, so what to do for eighth grade. So here again, I can tell you not only from my own experience, but from many eighth grade plays that I've seen performed in other schools. Definitely Shakespeare is wonderful because he's so connected to the consciousness soul, and you're probably going to be studying something about English history, and the life of Shakespeare may come in. So for many, many reasons, if you haven't done a Shakespeare play yet, it's great. However, you are under no obligation to do an entire Shakespeare play. There are a lot of good abridged versions that other teachers have done, especially with old stalwarts like A Midsummer Night's Dream or As You Like It. There are lots of good abridged versions of those. Roberto Trusley did sections from Shakespeare plays, from different Shakespeare plays, and sort of had kind of bridged them together. I'm not quite sure how he did it, but I know a number of class teachers have done it that way. They've really liked it. It's like a kind of survey of Shakespearean comedies on the theme of love. So that's a nice way of doing it. If you've already done Shakespeare or you don't want to do Shakespeare, there is a play that I would say is the play that Shakespeare wanted to write but could not write in his lifetime. So instead, he inspired the great German playwright and poet Friedrich Schiller to write it. So Schiller wrote this play about 300 years after Shakespeare, after Shakespeare's time. And this is the play in German, Maria Stuart, in English, Mary Stuart. This is one of the greatest, greatest Shakespearean dramas that Shakespeare didn't get to write himself. If you have two girls in your class who are real powerhouses and who have it in for each other, have a lot to work out with each other. Many eighth grades are in this situation. You could not do a more perfect play than this one. So I would recommend it very strongly. And Kelly, it might be something you'd want to do because it's about Elizabeth the First and her cousin, Mary Stuart, and the conflict of the Protestants, of the Catholics. It's the most incredible play about politics, intrigue, cattiness, jealousy, and so on. It's got a lot in it. It's very, very powerful. So that's, I'd recommend that one. It's not performed very often. It's very hard to find many translations of it into English. There might be something in Spanish, Margarita. I don't know. Schiller is not nearly as popular anymore as he used to be, but have a look at that. Another play, especially if you don't have a big class, that eighth graders can do very well is Our Town by Thornton Wilder. And it's a play that, as many of you know, it's very, very often performed. It takes place in a little American town in New Hampshire at the beginning of the 20th century. And it just shows, in a way, how the most simple details of life are also the most profound. It's a play that I have never known a class to do this play that did not hate it when they started it. They complained bitterly. This is so boring. These people are so stupid. Who cares about these dumb people in this little town? They're such idiots. Don't they, you know, one thing after another. And many teachers, I get calls, you know, my class hates it. I can't do it. They refuse to perform it. The reality is, though, give them about 3 weeks of working with it a little bit every day, and they suddenly, something turns, and this play works its magic on them. I would say it comes probably about the closest of any American play to being a mystery drama. And young people really experience it, that there's something here that speaks very, very deeply to them. Because it really is very much about, it's a play about the astral body. It's really the story of how the astral body works into a group of people. So it's very beautiful, very powerful, and you could do it with a group of, you know, 8 or 10 kids very well. You could do it with a large class as well. It makes itself, it's very well adaptable for double casting if you need to do that. So that's a very good play to do with kids. Another one, if you have a very large class and a class that's very talkative, very a little bit on the wild side, another Thornton Wilder play, The Skin of Our Teeth, is it's very powerful. Also a real mystery drama, which is all about evolution. You could say that our town is about the mysteries of life and death. And The Skin of Our Teeth is about the mysteries of Earth evolution. And it's a very, very wonderful play as well that I've seen classes do very successfully. Now, Kelly mentioned her class wants a musical, and this is not unusual. Often in larger, more established schools, especially the high school, the students see the high school kids getting to sing and dance. Maybe they like to watch the show Glee on TV or something, whatever it is. Kids nowadays really want to do this. That's a lot of work, and you really need to have a whole group of parents behind you and, of course, a very good group of music teachers. Even if you yourself are a good musical director, you're going to need others who will be rehearsing the separate parts and things like that. One of the most powerful musicals I've ever seen done by a group of students, it could be done on a high school level, but I saw it done with eighth graders in the City of Lakes Waldorf School, which is in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's called The Secret Garden, and it's based on the children's classic. And it is a very, very beautiful, very powerful musical, but it really requires, I would say, several months of preparation to get a class up to that level. There's some very demanding solo parts in singing, as well as lovely parts for ensembles. And it's a beautiful, very powerful play. So that's one I could recommend. Some eighth grades have done Fiddler on the Roof. Mm-hmm. Some have done Gilbert and Sullivan. What's nice about Gilbert and Sullivan is it's done so widely all over America that you can rent costumes, you know, that you don't even have to worry about doing that. You can get them that will fit your eighth graders exactly. So those are some other popular ones. Very often a smaller school will put together three grades. Maybe they'll have 6th and 7th and 8th graders doing the musical together, with the 8th graders doing the larger parts, the solos, and the younger grades doing the ensemble parts. That's a way of doing it. But then you need an incredible amount of cooperation. And the specialty teachers had better agree with this, because a lot of language classes, a lot of handwork classes are going to be sacrificed to doing a musical. So those are some suggestions. I once saw a production of Arthur Miller's The Crucible done by an eighth grade, but it was a very mature eighth grade. It certainly can be done. It's related to American history about the witch hunts in Salem. If you have an eighth grade where you've got a lot of issues of kids manipulating their parents, spreading stories about one another, social networking issues, things like that, the crucible might be the right play to do. But you want to read it this summer and get your own feeling about whether this would be too much for your class. It's really a high school play at the youngest, or even a college play. But I have seen one eighth grade that really needed that story do it very, very well. Okay, so that's a little bit about class plays. And just another question. I would say one other thing. I mentioned the musical. You need months of preparation. If you're going to do a Shakespeare play, my suggestion is by the third week of school, the children get their scripts, and you just start to read together for 10 minutes, 15 minutes at the most, three times a week, four times a week at the beginning of main lesson. You read aloud. You go through the whole play reading it aloud like that. Maybe if a specialty teacher is absent, you take out your scripts and read a little bit more. Then you read it all over again, but this time you start to go through the vocabulary and start to help the children understand the metaphors and the similes and the images, make some sense of the language. Then you go through it again with an eye on the drama. And that's when you have the kids actually sort of auditioning a little bit, coming up and reading parts. So if you're going to do the play in April or even May, start working on it no later than early October. Make that play part of their, you know, their soul and spirit, that they have totally permeated it and incarnated into that play. And then when they speak Shakespeare's lines, they won't mumble. The audience will understand what they're saying, and even they will understand what they're saying, and it will really come to life. So it's a big investment of time, but if you do a little bit over a long period of time in a rhythmical way, that's the way to do it. You know, don't suddenly panic to cancel everything that the kids are learning in order to, you know, rush and get this play on. Give yourself lots of time. In Green Meadow, thank goodness we had a tradition that parents knew, starting even in fourth or fifth grade, children would have to come after school to do rehearsals for a few weeks before the play. Parents were accustomed to coming in 3-4 weekends and working with the teacher on sets and props with the children there, helping the teacher rehearse. So you really need extra time, and you have to start that tradition in your school if it's not already there, that for the upper grades to do a really good class play, you just can't cancel one specialty class after another. You've got to let school go forward as good, and then, you know, just work after school or whatever as best you can with that. Okay, one more. And that's, Teresa, you asked the question about student speeches at the eighth grade graduation, or you call it the promotion. Some schools, especially with high schools, don't like it being called graduation because it sounds like the kids are leaving. Okay, so should this, you said that last year's eighth grade teacher had each student write a short 1-minute speech about their struggles, gifts, and wishes for the future. Should that be done? I would say no. I think it's much better if the students choose two of their own to speak on their behalf, and that those two students work with you. You know, that you kind of proofread what they're writing out and what their ideas are, and you bounce ideas around with them. And they also talk with their parents, and maybe they talk with the class parent and go over things that, you know, they're given. They're not chosen a week before graduation, that they're given lots of time to work and really craft beautiful speeches that don't just, you know, share their memories of how you got lost on various class trips or how you forgot a story or something like that, that they really are going to share with the audience, and we go back to that audience again, they're going to share the very best, as well as humorously bring up some of the not so best things. So I think that's a better way of doing it. When children in eighth grade are asked to share their wishes for the future, what are they going to say? I wish for world peace. I wish that the earth would be taken care of. I hope that we don't, you know, destroy our beautiful planet. I wish for world peace. I wish that there were an end to war. I wish that all people would be good to each other. I wish that girls in Afghanistan could go to school. I mean, come on. They're just going to say the things that they hear people saying all around them. It's not coming out of them yet. They just learned in seventh grade wish, wonder, and surprise. They just even learned what a wish is. And I would say that all they're going to do is just repeat what they've heard on television or what their parents are talking about. It's not going to be original. Much better if you help two kids in the class to try to craft something, which will take them time, that really has a bit of originality in it, that really has something creative. And I'm, even though my own class graduated 7 years ago, my youngest daughter just graduated from eighth grade a few weeks ago. So this is all very fresh with me. And I would say on the whole, I'm not going to name the school she was in, but the school did a pretty, pretty poor job of arranging how all of this stuff would work. You could feel how thrown together it was. And the children's speeches were just very, very disappointing. And they could feel it themselves. You could just feel it in their delivery. They knew that they weren't prepared and that what they were saying was just kind of cliche. So help them move beyond that. You know, I don't think a graduation has to have everybody doing something or everybody doing everything. I think a few students, like the chamber music group perhaps, or, you know, a few speakers, two perhaps is plenty, can represent the others. And then everybody can recite poetry, or everybody can sing, or maybe the class orchestra can play. But I would not feel everyone needs to have an individual voice. I don't think that that's really essential in eighth grade. Even in high school, that doesn't happen. There again, it'll only be two or three students speaking on behalf of everyone. All right, well, let me stop there. And before I go on to talking more specifically about the curriculum, any questions or comments about the many things I just covered? Thank you all for, you know, entering those questions. They're very, very helpful subjects to talk about. No questions? No comments?
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. I'll just go ahead and forge ahead into the curriculum. Now, if anybody wants to go online and go to our webpage, and you'll see there I have a link to the eighth grade main lesson blocks. And I am looking at a slightly different, I have two sets of blocks, one that I wrote out from the class that I graduated around 1995. And then I took 5 years off and did teacher training at Sunbridge, and then another that I graduated 7 years ago in 2005. So basically, this was my block rotation. We began with geometry and nature, of which you have a slideshow of what they did. We went on then to history part one, in which we did Galileo, Copernicus, the astronomical revolution, the Reformation, and English history. We got that far in that part one. Then we went on to mathematics, and there we worked with a thorough review, which took a lot of time. And of course, meanwhile, we're doing mental math every day in main lesson. I'll tell you more about that in a little while. So it isn't like math just started in late October. We were already working up to it. But the main new topics that we covered were number systems, number bases. So we learned, you know, base 10, base 12, base 6, above all base 2, and understood then how the binary system works into the world of computation and electronics. And we also learned quadratic equations. Now, I'll just say, you know, with a caveat about that, as Jamie York says in his wonderful books about math, you do not have to do quadratic equations in eighth grade. My class was definitely ready for it, so we could get away with that. But in Jamie's feeling, even linear algebra, even linear equations, simple things like x plus 3 equals 7, even those are not so important. If the children really, they need the basis in basic arithmetic and basic math. Speak about that later. After that, mid-November to early December, we did human anatomy, the skeletal system. December 6th up until our Christmas break on the 17th, we did meteorology. So that was a short block. Then we came back from Christmas vacation in January, did organic chemistry. That was followed late January, February break, by the second part of history, in which we took up the Age of Revolutions. There we had our American history, our Glorious Revolution in England, and also the French Revolution. And later on, we also went a little bit further in history, but that was in extra mains. February 28th, right after midwinter break to mid-March, we had 4 weeks of physics. So we really covered a lot of ground there. And then the month of April was completely dedicated to our class play preparation. So that meant main lesson time was class play work. That did not mean that they missed anything else. They had all of their other specialty classes. They never missed a single period of handwork, language, PE, or anything like that. Then in late April through May, we did world geography, and that was basically it. May 31st to June 3rd was our class trip, and then we had what I call June 6th to June 10th, our finale, which is something that Steiner suggested, that at the end of every year, there is a grand recapitulation of what the students learned that year. And we did a grand recapitulation of what the students had learned for eight grades. So I would say that entered into every block, and I mentioned this, of course, in the slideshows, that it's really good to point out to the students again and again in their main lesson blocks, remember you did this in grade one, or remember in grade three, I told you we'd be learning this again, and now is the time. So that's something good to do. Now, Mark had asked, he also entered a emailed a question. He said that he wondered about this breathing, expansion and contraction, that it's new for me to verbalize and intellectually grapple with, but it's completely organic and understandable. Now, if you look at the curriculum that I've given you and that I actually did, this is a casebook study in non-breathing, really, because the breathing often is you go from science or math into humanities. From humanities, you go back to math. From math, you go to humanities. Humanities, you go to science. But if you look at my curriculum, it's geometry followed by history. Okay, that's breathing, followed by mathematics. Then they're breathing in again. Fine. Followed by human anatomy. That's really breathing in. Followed by meteorology as a science. That's also technically breathing in. Followed by organic chemistry. Yes, that's right. We didn't get to history again until late January. But here again, not just the subjects in and of themselves are automatically breathing in and breathing out. It's the way in which you teach them. You know, that you can teach meteorology with storms and the various currents of air around the earth. It can be a completely excarnating, breathing out experience for students. And that's how I taught it, because they had really gone very, very deeply in human anatomy. It would be unhealthy for them. You can't take them any more deeply than their skeletal system. You've got to take them out. So we really work with a greater emphasis on storms in this meteorology block, and less of an emphasis on sort of everyday weather and methods of. So it was more about weather and less about climate. If you teach meteorology more about climate, then you're teaching about the regularity and aspects that are predictable, you know, although up to our time anyway. You talk about weather, you're talking about something that's very exciting, that has a very strong astral quality. Organic chemistry, again, was coming in more, especially looking at processes of digestion of all of these foods that they study. History, the revolution, we went way out, really, really far out there in the revolution. My class was creating petitions every few days, going around asking a petition to abolish the dress code, a petition to abolish haircut regulations, a petition against banning tattoos, and so on. They had a wonderful time with redressing their grievances. And then we went in again in physics. And then the rest of the year, I would say, was just out, no matter what I would have done. By Easter of eighth grade, your students are quite a difficult group altogether to, you know, contain. You've really got to get most of your groundwork done. Whatever you want to accomplish, plan to get it done before Easter, because after that, everything, the excitement towards the graduation, the class play, the class trip, all of that becomes a very, very powerful force with which to contend. So that's the general outline. And I would say again, I'm going to, you know, talk now about more of the content in specifics, but please, I beg you, you know, don't take this as the archetype or the prototype or, you know, the model that you have to fit yourself into. This was my way of finding a solution to what is inherently the problem of teaching eighth grade at all. You know, all of this stuff, it's like eighth grade blocks are not nourishment anymore, they're medicine, because you're dealing with a group of children who in a certain way hardly belong to you anymore, hardly belong with you anymore, and are already, their horizons are widening greatly. So you have to kind of go along with those widening horizons. So again, I've covered some of this in the slideshows, and I won't go into too much detail. Geometry and nature was not done instead of Platonic forms and solid geometry. However, what we did was to work with solid geometry in our extra mains once a week for a good part of the winter. So that was something that we did outside of the main lesson, because we did it a lot through modeling. And we also happened to have the very good fortune in our high school of having a math teacher named David Booth, who now teaches at the Waldorf School in Austin, Texas. And David was one of a group of men, guys in New Mexico, who invented these remarkable tools which could depict geometrical forms. You could create, they were like tinker toys, but on a very sophisticated level, and you could create geometrical forms with them. So he came in and brought hundreds of these pieces, And the children then were able to construct all kinds of elaborate three-dimensional forms, understanding the relationship of the Platonic forms and the Platonic solids to others. So we were in a very special position. I did not have to do the Platonic solids in the main lesson. I would hope you don't have to choose one or the other, because I think the geometry in nature class is a wonderful culmination, summation of all of the geometry that they've done in the early grades. And it's, you know, I think you could see their work and see how deeply and how engaged they got into the whole thing. History, you saw a lot of that, of the student work there. And then mathematics, as I said, every day in eighth grade, every single day, we did 5 to 10 minutes of mental arithmetic. And I would say that's the most important thing, almost the most important thing we could do throughout the entire years of being a grade teacher. Mental arithmetic, making sure that the children can really work with numbers and live with numbers within, that this speaks to the inner life of the eighth grader. Even when they're working with pencil and paper and they're carrying and borrowing, let's say, or they're, you know, subtracting rapidly in long division, they have to do a lot of that in their heads. They can't do every single thing on paper, and certainly we hope not with their fingers. So make sure that they're sharp and clear in their mental arithmetic work, and give them ever more difficult problems. And also, you know, I work with different books on shortcuts in mental arithmetic, giving children hints on how, let's say, if you're multiplying, you know, 46 by 8, that you're really multiplying 40 times 8. Hold that number. Plus 6 times 8. Hold that number. Now add those two together. To work in that way, in which they really start to understand that what you do on paper is not the way you're going to work these problems out within. So that's very important. And that went on before the math block and after the math block. And as I said then, the main work was for them to become mobile and flexible in the way they're working with numbers. On the one hand, with different number systems, number bases, realizing that there are many ways for us to see, you know, number systems that can express the numbers we know in different ways, almost like learning a foreign language, but in the numerical basis. And with the binary system, to realize that that was discovered hundreds of years before computers were invented, and it was just seen as a mathematical folly. You know, how nice that you could do that, but what difference does it make? There's no practical application for it. It's good for them to realize that in math, sometimes the discoveries far outstrip any use for them, that sometimes humanity needs to evolve centuries before they can really do anything with something, a principle that a mathematician has discovered. Quadratic equations, the same thing. The flexibility, the imaginativeness that they need to be able to understand that the problem will have two answers. Each of them is correct. One of them is generally going to be positive, the other generally, though not always, negative. How can that be? How can one problem have two solutions? How wonderful for eighth graders who can often get very fixed and stuck in one way or another on only one way of doing something. How liberating for them. So that's why I taught quadratic equations to my class, not so much because I wanted them to be brilliant in high school or be ahead of everybody, but because they needed that kind of flexibility. So that was our other important thing that we did in math in that block. Human anatomy, there again, the slideshow shows you, you know, quite a bit. And I try to raise some of the issues there. to have a skeleton or not to have a skeleton in the room. There again, your hands may be tied. Your school may not own a skeleton anyway. That solves the problem. Or the school may have a skeleton that's dedicated for the eighth grade. And if you don't use it, you'll be the first person. And their brothers and sisters use that skeleton. So sometimes you have to do it. But if you do, proceed really cautiously.